Well, Shalom Hadavarnix. Welcome to Hadavar Messianic Ministry School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the Jewish life of the Messiah. This is the 2021 edition, and we're in lesson 11, and this is session number 40. So let's go ahead and review session 39. Now in session 39, Yeshua pronounced seven woes against the Pharisees. The first one, woe to you for rejecting the Messiah, rejecting his Messiahship. This, of course, leads to misleading others. Woe to you for misleading others. Misleading others leads to improper priorities, and therefore incorrect emphases, putting the emphasis on the minors rather than the majors. External actions become more prominent, more important, along with external appearances. And with all this going on, this leads to rejection of the prophets. And once you reject the prophets, of course, you've rejected the Messiah. So this was a bad cycle that the Pharisees had gotten involved in. Now, Jesus went on to say that that Jewish generation would be responsible for all of the scriptures, all of everything that was revealed in Tanakh. And why was that? Well, we gave you three reasons. Number one, the Tanakh, the Old Testament, revelation was complete and available, and it verified Yeshua. Secondly, we had John the Baptist's proclamation. He verified Yeshua. And thirdly, the personal ministry of the Messiah himself. He verified himself. So there were a matter is confirmed by two or three witnesses in Scripture, and so here are three witnesses confirming that Yeshua is indeed the Messiah. We also talked about the basis of Messiah's second coming. He will not return until they say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. In other words, he will not return until Israel asks him to return. We have to beg him to return, ask him to come back. Then we went into the temple. We went down into the court of the women, and we observed a poor widow putting the legally minimum amount of offering into the trumpet-shaped offering boxes. And she was noticed by Yeshua. He pointed her out, and she was an example of faith and love and commitment, because she gave all. She was very different from the majority of the offerers, because the majority, the rich, for example, this fella, put in out of their surplus. But she put in out of everything she had to live on. And here's a picture of a widow's mite, about the size of an American dime, the smallest, least valuable coin in Israel at that day. Then we talked about an application, the theme, the importance of godly attitudes. We've got to really do an attitude check every day and make sure we're more like the widow than the world. Now Yeshua left the court of the women and went to the Mount of Olives. Now we don't know exactly which route they took, but I took you on probably the most direct route. He leaves the area in front of the treasury. He goes over to the eastern gate of the temple. Going through the gate, he then goes through the Soreg and then takes a turn to the north, going along Solomon's portico. He travels along beside Solomon's portico until he comes to the eastern gate, or the what's known today as the Golden Gate. Then he could have very easily walked down the stairs and through the Golden Gate, down the next set of stairs to the ground, and then taken a left-hand turn and gone through the city gate and along the bridge that led to the Mount of Olives. So Yeshua is now on the Mount of Olives with his disciples. We did a little bit of a trip down memory lane and looked at the history of the temple. Solomon's temple began when Solomon built a 500-cubit square platform to flatten off Mount Moriah. He then placed the temple upon that platform. Well, that temple lasted until 586 when the Babylonians destroyed the temple. And so that platform was devoid of the temple for a number of years until the Jewish people returned from Babylon. And under Zerubbabel, we built a second temple. Wasn't as magnificent, but at least the temple was up and functioning again. Then, during the Greek period, the Maccabees threw the Greeks out of the land, and the Hasmoneans then extended the Temple Mount platform a little bit to the south, did some improvements to it. Then during the Roman time, Herod came along and, wow, he really did a bang-up job. He totally remodeled the platform from top to bottom, adding a lot of territory to the platform to the north and to the south. Well, the Romans destroyed that temple in 70 AD, and so the Temple Mount was again devoid of buildings and the temple. During the Muslim period, some palaces were built around the southern end of the temple, and then eventually the Muslims got around to building the Dome of the Rock, where the temple used to stand, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is what you see on the temple platform today. Now, when the Romans destroyed the temple, it burned to the ground. A Roman soldier, apparently by accident, or at least not by the, it's not claimed that Titus ordered it, a torch got thrown into the temple and everything burned to the ground. So all we have left to look at is rubble. Now we'll be looking at this area of the temple. This is Herod's temple in all its glory. And on this southwest corner, there were a lot of shops and a Herodian street. And you can visit that street today. You can see the shops on the left side, the rubble that dropped down from the Temple Mount itself on the right side, and then the Herodian Street. You can almost bet your retirement that Yeshua walked that street many, many times. It's quite an impressive place to go, the Southern Temple Mount Archaeological Garden. And the reason that the Temple Mount was bare is because Yeshua predicted it would be bare. He said, not one stone would be left upon another which will not be torn down. And that was exactly true. The entire platform was torn apart and all the buildings removed. And so there it sat without anything upon it until the Muslims came and began to build upon it again. I believe the Romans also put some structures up on the platform in the interim as well. So Yeshua is up on the Mount of Olives, and he's answering questions from his disciples. And he begins by sharing some general characteristics of the church age. The first characteristic of the church age is that there will be a rise of messiahs. Many will come in my name saying, I am the Messiah. Another characteristic of the church age is wars and rumors of wars. But he said, that does not mark the end of the age. The end is not yet. All right, that brings us now to the new material. And we're now going to discuss the end, the sign of the end of the age. This is page 20 in the top of your outline if you've downloaded it. So we pick it up here in Matthew 24, verses 7 and 8. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are merely the beginning of the birth pangs. So this is just the beginning. A nation rising against nation is just the beginning of birth pains. Now, it's a common theme among the prophets to describe the end of the age like a series of labor pains a woman goes through before giving birth. So the last days of the church age, this age, will be like a series of labor pains giving birth to a new age. So, what is the first birth pang that signals the beginning of the end of the age? That first sign will be when nation rises against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Now, this is different. This is different from wars and rumors of wars. The term is a Jewish idiom that means a world war. A world war is the beginning of the end. A local war, a rumor of a war, is simply a general characteristic of the church age, and we see that even today. There's still plenty of wars and rumors of wars going around even today. Now, this is very rabbinic in nature. If you pick up the book Footsteps of the Messiah by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum, which I recommend very, very highly, on page 95, you'll read the quote from Zohar Chadash. At that time, wars will be started up in the world. See, this is worldwide in nature. Nation shall be against nation and city against city. Much distress shall be renewed against the enemies of the Israelites. And also on page 95, Midrash Rabbah, if you shall see kingdoms rising against each other in turn, then give heed and note the footsteps of the Messiah. So what's the beginning of the end of the church age? World War I. World War I would mark the beginning. Now, what was the impact of World War I and World War II on the Jewish community? Well, before World War I came to an end, there was a very significant document published. World War I lasted from 1914 to 1918. During that time, the Zionist movement gained prominence. It gained so much prominence that the Balfour Declaration was issued. Here's a picture of the original Balfour Declaration, and here is a picture of Lord Arthur James Balfour, the author of this declaration. He wrote, Foreign Office, November 2, 1917. Dear Lord Rothschild, Rothschild was the leader of the Zionist Federation in England. Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours sincerely, Arthur James Balfour. Very critical and important declaration. Well, when World War I was over, the Middle East was divided up among Britain and France, and Britain and France were given the mandate for nation building. And so this was the area called Palestine. This is the area allocated for a Jewish national home. It was allocated by the League of Nations at the San Remo Conference in 1920. That area, that entire area, was to be the Jewish national home. Well, it didn't remain that way for long because the British had some allies they had to please. And so the British divided up the mandated area into Palestine and Transjordan. Everything to the east became an Arab national home known as Jordan today. And everything to the west of the Jordan River would be Palestine or the Jewish national home. So the Jewish national home got reduced by quite a bit. A huge percentage of it was given away by Britain. That's 1921 to 1923. Well, then World War II showed up, and World War II was just a continuation of World War I. Well, at the end of World War II, the UN General Assembly, the United Nations was formed to replace the League of Nations. And the Arabs were unhappy, totally unhappy with the thought of a Jewish national home, even though it was the original home of the Jewish people and that they lived in the area before the Arabs came in. They objected to a Jewish national home and fought against it. Well, then the UN came up with Resolution 181, a partition plan in 1947 to divide up the area to the east of the Jordan River into a Jewish state and an Arab state. And so that was done, reducing the Jewish national home even further. Well, the Arabs didn't like it. And when the area was turned loose from the mandate, from the British mandate, they attacked. And guess what? The tiny little Jewish country won. A miracle of God. A very clear miracle of God. And they gained territory. They even gained some of the territory that had been given away. And so this is the armistice lines from 1948 till 1967. In 1967, Israel won another miraculous war against Arab neighbors, taking the Sinai, the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. The Sinai Peninsula was eventually negotiated back to Egypt for a peace treaty. And this is the way the Nation of Israel looks pretty much today. It's pretty much today. The Gaza Strip has been given to as a Palestinian home. The West Bank is in flux, but Israel still holds on to the Golan Heights. So that's Israel today. Now, if you want a very detailed class on Zionism and Modern Israel, go to our YouTube channel, Hadavar Ministries channel, and look for the title Zionism 2019 Edition. The formal name of the class is The First Regathering, Zionism and Modern Israel. And you'll get a very detailed, extensive class on the history of the modern state and Zionism. So we hope you take an opportunity to take a look at that class. All right, we're now let's take a look at the personal experiences of the apostles. Yeshua now explains what the apostles and disciples are going to go through. He makes 8 points. This is page 21 on your outline. Yeshua says that the disciples will be rejected by the Jewish community. This is Luke 21:12, first part of the verse. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and prisons. Now, note, before these things, before World War I, these things will happen. So this will happen to the apostles and the disciples. So they'll be rejected by the Jewish community. Secondly, they'll be rejected by the Gentiles. Second part of the verse, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. And we see this literally happen in the life of Rabbi Shaul, the Apostle Paul, in Acts 13:50. But the Jews incited the devout women of prominence and the leading men of the city and instigated a persecution against Paul and Barnabas and drove them out of their district. And then in Acts 14:5-6, another example. And when an attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to mistreat and stone them, they became aware of it and fled to the cities of Lycaonia, Lystra, and Derbe, and the surrounding region. So the rejection by the Jewish community and the Gentiles was quite literal and quite soon in Paul's life. But there's a good side to all this. The persecution will provide opportunities for witness in verse 13. It will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. They'll be able to testify about Yeshua to kings and princes, to high-ranking government leaders. And when they do, God will give them the words to say when they're brought to the judgment seat, verses 14 and 15. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves, for I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. So they will have a very exciting witness life when they go to court. All right, let's move on to verse 12. Mark 13, verse 12. There we read, brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and have them put to death. So the disciples will be rejected by families. Verse 13. You will be hated by all because of my name, but the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. So they'll be hated by all segments of society. And the parallel verses expand a little bit on the Mark account, Luke 21:16-18. But you will be betrayed, even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. And you will be hated by all because of my name. Yet not a hair on your head will perish. Now, some think that verse 18 speaks of spiritual salvation. Some think the statement refers to physical salvation. I think spiritual salvation is preferable in view of verse 16. Verse 16 says some of you will die. And not all the apostles survived physically. So most were martyred. For example, James in Acts 2:12. And John, I believe, is the only apostle that died a natural death. However, all the apostles, all the disciples are eternally secure, no matter what persecution they encounter or what kind of death they experience. Their salvation is assured in verse 18. All right, let's move on to verse 19. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. Now, another somewhat unclear statement. Some think it refers to spiritual survival. Others think it refers to physical survival. Some think it refers to evangelism. And I'm one of those guys. I tend to lean toward the view that it's a reference to evangelism. In spite of all that the apostles have to endure, they will see fruit from their testimony. They will see fruit from their labors. They will win souls. They will gain the lives of those they evangelize. Okay, at this point, I have to disagree a bit with the harmony that we're using. You know, Thomas and Gundry put Luke 21, 20 through 24 in the next section. But Luke 21, 20 through 24 belongs here, not in section 204. All right, so we now come to the sign of the fall of Jerusalem. This is page 23 in your outline. It is section 204 in your harmony, if you're following along in your harmony of the Gospels. This will be in section 204, not in section 203. All right, well, let's pick it up in Luke 21, 20 through 24. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be a great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So this is the answer to question number one. When Jerusalem is encompassed by armies, then you know that her desolation is at hand. And by the way, we also see in these verses the definition of the times of the Gentiles. When Jerusalem is under Gentile oppression, it indicates the times of the Gentiles. Now, this does not eliminate temporary times of sovereignty in Jerusalem. But the times of the Gentiles started in 586 BC with the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem. It continues clear through to the Second Coming. And there is a period of Jewish sovereignty over most of Jerusalem right now, but that will disappear when the tribulation, Holocaust begins, and Jerusalem again is totally trodden down by the Gentiles, only to be relieved and come to an end when Yeshua returns. So that's the times of the Gentiles, Jerusalem under Gentile domination. All right, now, their response to the destruction of Jerusalem, how should they get out of the city? They're told to get out of the city. Well, how did this work out historically? Well, historically it went like this. In AD 66, the Roman Sestus Gallus surrounded Jerusalem with his armies. The Jewish Christians, the Messianic Jews, took this as a fulfillment of Luke 21, 20 through 24. But how in the world could they leave? The city was totally surrounded by Romans. Well, it turned out it was a short siege. The supply lines were cut by zealots. The siege was lifted. Gallus retreated. And on his way back to Caesarea Philippi, he was killed. He was killed. Now, the Messianic Jews took the opportunity to leave Judea and go to Pella. Here's Jerusalem. Jerusalem was under siege. The siege was lifted. And up to the north here is Pella. So the Messianic Jews obeyed the command. They went eastward over the mountains, the Judean hills, down into the Jordan Valley and up the Jordan Valley to Pella. And they waited out the war there in Pella. Well, in AD 68, Vespasian re-besieged the city. The Romans came back. Vespasian was called to Rome to become the emperor. His son Titus took over, and in AD 70, the city and the temple were destroyed. 1,100,000 Jewish people lost their lives in the first Jewish rebellion. Not a single Messianic Jew lost their life. Why? Because they obeyed Luke 21, 21. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city. They fled the city, and they waited out the war in Pella. All right, now go to page 24, lesson 11. We're back to section 203 now in the harmony, page 196, 197, in the harmony. All right, so back on page 203, we now begin to discuss the Great Tribulation. We begin to look at the events in the first half of the tribulation. Let's talk a little bit about the issue of timing. Now, in Matthew 24, 9 through 14, that section of Scripture is not parallel to Luke 21, verses 12 through 19. So Matthew 24, 9 through 14 is not parallel to Luke 21, 12 through 19. Now, harmony has them laid out that way, but I disagree with the harmony. Why? Well, Luke says before in Luke 21, 12. Matthew says then in chapter 24, verse 9. And the word in Matthew is used of subsequent events. So the timing of this point is crucial. Matthew and Luke are not recording the same events. Luke records the events before World War I and World War II. Luke is recording the general characteristics of the church age. Matthew records events after World War I and World War II. Matthew is recording the tribulation. He jumps to the very end of the age. He's down at the end of the age in the tribulation. All right, so let's take a look at the events in the second half of the tribulation, starting in Matthew 24, verses 9 and 10. Then, see, afterwards, after all this happens, after World War I and after World War II, sometime after the world wars, then they will deliver you to what? To tribulation. It's a reference to the tribulation period. And will kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations because of my name. At that time, many will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another. So there'll be a persecution of saints during the first half of the tribulation. I should say during the second half of the tribulation. Excuse me. Let me repeat that again. During the first half of the tribulation, there'll be persecution of the saints, Jewish saints primarily. Then in verse 24:11, many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. So this is the arise of false prophets during the tribulation, the first half of the tribulation. Verse 12, lawlessness. Because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will draw cold. So there'll be a tremendous increase of evil because the restraint of evil is removed. And we know the restrainer is in 2 Thessalonians 2, 6 and 7. And you know what restrains, it's the Holy Spirit, you know what restrains him now. So that in his time the Antichrist, will be revealed. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work, only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. So the Holy Spirit is the third person of the Godhead, and he is restraining evil in the world even today. Let's move on to verse 13. But the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. So there'll be Jewish people surviving to the end of the tribulation, and they will be saved. And this is exactly what Zechariah 13, 8 and 9 states. It will come about in all the land, a better translation would be earth or world. This is worldwide in nature. It will come about in all the world, declares the Lord, that two parts in it will be cut off and perish, but the third will be left in it. This is a reference to the Jewish community. Two-thirds of the worldwide Jewish community will perish during the tribulation Holocaust. And I will bring the third part through the fire. This is one-third of the worldwide Jewish community. And refine them as silver is refined and test them as gold is tested. And they will call on my name and I will answer them. I will say they are my people, and they will say the Lord is my God. So Israel is physically and spiritually saved. One-third of the nation makes it to the tribulation physically, and then they spiritually come to faith in Yeshua. And this is exactly what Romans 11, 25 and 26 talks about. For I do not want you, brethren, to be uninformed of this mystery, so that you will not be wise in your own estimation. That a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved, just as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion and remove ungodliness from Jacob. So every living Jewish man, woman, and child will come to faith in Yeshua at the end of the tribulation period. All right, verse 14. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. So the gospel is going to be preached worldwide, and there are four resources that God will use to send that preaching worldwide. Probably the most significant is the 144,000 of Revelation 7. Here, that revelation is made to us. In verses 4 and 5, that revelation is brought out. And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. So there'll be 144,000 Jewish Billy Grahams out there winning people to the Messiah. Then the results of their ministry is in verses 9 and 10. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lord. So they're going to have a very, very successful evangelistic ministry. They're clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands, and they cry out with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." So that's the results of the 144,000's ministry. And then verses 13 and 14 actually identify those who are saved. Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, "These who are clothed in the white robes, who are they? And where have they come from?" And I said, "My Lord, you know." And he said to me, "These are the ones who came out of the great tribulation. They've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." So there they are. Tremendous ministry by the 144,000. Now here are the additional sources of gospel witness. In Revelation 14:6, an angel is used. "And I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth, and to every nation and tribe and tongue and people." So this angel will have a tremendous ministry of witness as well. And then in Malachi 4:5, Elijah. "Behold, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord." So he'll have a great ministry. And then in Revelation 11:3, the two witnesses, "And I will grant authority to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1260 days clothed in sackcloth." So those are the sources of evangelism during the tribulation: the 144,000, this angel, Elijah, and the two witnesses. And it'll be a tremendous harvest for God during the tribulation period. Tremendous harvest. All right, let's go to lesson 11, page 25 at the top of the page, section 204, dealing with the abomination of desolation. Now this section deals with events in the second half of the tribulation. We just looked at events in the first half of the tribulation. Now we look at events in the second half of the tribulation. Yeshua makes 8 points. The tribulation begins with the abomination of desolation. The Antichrist takes over the temple. He seats himself in the Holy of Holies. He declares himself God. Matthew 24:15. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand." So there's the abomination of desolation, but this note is expanded by 2 Thessalonians. We get more information in 2 Thessalonians 2, 3, and 4. "Let no one in any way deceive you, for it," he's talking of the day of the Lord, the tribulation, "it will not come unless the apostasy comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed." And of course, that's the Antichrist. "The son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God." Now, we know here from this verse that the temple is up and functioning in the middle of the tribulation. The temple has to be up and functioning by the middle of the tribulation, because 2 Thessalonians tells us that the Antichrist will take his seat in the temple of God. And you know, currently there are organizations moving to get that third temple built. For example, you can go to the Temple Institute website and read their purpose statement. "The Temple Institute's ultimate goal is to see Israel rebuild the Holy Temple on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem in accord with the biblical commandments. www.templeinstitute.org. So go there to find out where they're up to these days. It's a fascinating, fascinating website. And then the Temple Mount and Land of Israel Faithful Movement. The goal of the Temple Mount and Land of Israel Faithful Movement is the building of the temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem in our lifetime. www.templemountfaithful.org. So they're working hard to get the third temple in place as well. The sad thing is the fact that these Jewish groups don't have the New Testament revelation. They don't believe it. They don't read it. And so they don't realize that they're actually working for the building of the third temple, which is a temple that will be rejected by Yeshua and desecrated by the Antichrist. He will sit in the temple of God and proclaim himself to be God. Very sad. All right, now the result of the abomination of desolation is the flight of Israel. The tribulation diaspora begins, and it will run immediately and urgently at that time. Matthew 24:16. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not go back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. But pray that your flight will not be in the winter or on Shabbat. So three difficulties will occur if the abomination of desolation happens at the wrong time. It'll be difficult for those pregnant, those caring for small infants. There'll be a physical difficulty. And it'll be difficult to fly if it happens in winter. Environmental difficulty. And it'll be difficult to charge out of Jerusalem if it happens on the Sabbath. There'll be religious difficulty. So the practical response here is to pray. Pray that the abomination of desolation will not occur at the wrong time. Well, the third statement that Yeshua makes is a discussion of worldwide anti-Semitism in verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation, such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. You see, at this point, Revelation 12, Satan tries to destroy the Jews once and for all. Revelation 12, verses 13 through 16. And when the dragon, Satan, saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman, Israel, who gave birth to the young child, to the male child, Yeshua. But the two wings of a great eagle were given to the woman so that she could fly into the wilderness to her place, that's Bozra, where she was nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. And the serpent poured water like a river out of its mouth after the woman so that he might cause her to be swept away in the flood. And a flood is often used in Scripture as a symbol of a military invasion. So he chases after fleeing Israel. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out of his mouth. So somehow the environment is going to somehow intercede and help the Jewish people get safely to Bozra. And then again, the tribulation holocaust is described in Zechariah 13:8-9. It will come about in all the world, declares the Lord, that two parts in it will be cut off and perish, but the third will be left in it. And I will bring the third part through the fire and refine them as silver is refined and test them as gold is tested. They will call on my name, and I will answer them. I will say they are my people. They will say the Lord is my God. So again, two-thirds of the Jewish people will die during the tribulation period. The tribulation holocaust will make the holocaust of World War II look like a picnic in the park. It'll be twice as bad. That's why we need to be praying for the salvation of Israel today. Well, Satan knows the basis of the second coming, that Yeshua will not return until Israel asks him to come back. And his strategy revolves around the fact that if he can destroy Israel before Israel requests the Messiah's return, then Satan's career is going to be safe. Yeshua will not be back. Messiah will not come back. But nevertheless, Matthew 24:22, Israel will survive. Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Now, this term elect refers to Israel in context. It's not the church here. The church has been raptured. The church is not on earth at this time. All right, in spite of all that's going on, it'll be a time of false messiahs as well. Verse 23. Then if anyone says to you, behold, here's the Messiah, there he is, do not believe him. And it'll be a time of false prophets. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I've told you in advance. So if they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. Or behold, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe them. So this is going to be a time of unprecedented mass confusion as well. Because these false prophets will be able to perform miracles and see visions and all that good stuff. Zechariah 13, 2 through 6. It will come about in that day, declares the Lord of hosts, that it will cut off the names of the idols from the land, and they will no longer be remembered. And I will also remove the prophets and the unclean spirit from the land. And if anyone still prophesies, then his father and mother who gave birth to him will say to him, you shall not live, for you have spoken falsely in the name of the Lord. And his father and mother who gave birth to him will pierce him through when he prophesies. Also, it will come about in that day that the prophets will each be ashamed of his vision, which he prophesies, and they will not put on the hairy robe in order to deceive. But he will say, I'm not a prophet. I'm a tiller of the ground. For a man sold me as a slave in my youth. And one will say to him, what are these wounds between your arms? Then he will say, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. So the false prophets are going to be try to sneak out of their apostasy and their idolatry with all kinds all kinds of excuses. All right, 2 Thessalonians 2, 8 through 10 expands on this as well. Then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan and with all power and signs and false wonders. So miracles are going to happen during this time of false prophets. And with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth and so as to be saved. So it's going to be quite a time. The tribulation will be quite a time with miracles and counter miracles and prophets and false prophets. So it's going to be very confusing. But eventually all men will see the second coming in verse 27. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. And there it is, just as lightning comes. You sure don't need anybody to tell you when a lightning flash goes off. Everybody knows it. So Yeshua will come surrounded by the Shekinah glory. And then the place of the second coming is brought out, a very cryptic statement in verse 28. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Well, the vultures are the Gentile armies. The body, the corpse, the carcass is Israel. And the place for the second coming will be Petra or Basra in southern Jordan, in ancient Edom. Now we learn all this from Isaiah 34, verses 1 through 7. Draw near, O nations, to hear and listen, O peoples. Let the earth and all it contains hear, and the word and all that springs forth from it. For the Lord's indignation is against all the nations, and his wrath against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter. So their slain will be thrown out, and their corpses will give off their stench, and the mountains will be drenched with their blood. And all the host of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll, and all their hosts also wither away as a leaf withers from the vine, or as one withers from the fig tree. For my sword is satiated in heaven. Behold, it shall descend for judgment upon Edom and upon the people whom I have devoted to destruction. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is sated with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Basra and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. That sacrifice will be the armies of the Antichrist. Wild oxen will also fall with them, and young bulls with strong ones. Thus their land will be soaked with blood, and their dust become greasy with fat. So there's one verse that tells us about the second coming. Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6, expands our view of the second coming as well. Who is this who comes from Edom with garments of glowing colors from Bozrah? This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. So Isaiah is in Jerusalem. He's looking south toward Bozrah. And he sees this magnificent figure approaching, and he asks these questions. Why are you dressed like this? The magnificent figure answers, "It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save." Well, the only one who's righteous is Yeshua, and the only one mighty to save is Yeshua. So this is the Messiah speaking. Another question is asked by Isaiah. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads in the winepress? And Yeshua responds, "I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. I looked, there was no one to help. I was astonished, there was no one to uphold. So mine own arm brought salvation to me, and my wrath upheld me. I trod down the peoples in my anger and made them drunk on my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth." Pretty dramatic section of Scripture dealing with the second coming and Israel's salvation. And then there's Micah 2, 12 and 13. "I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together like sheep in the fold. The word Bozrah means sheepfold. I will put them together like sheep in Bozrah, sheep in the fold. Like a flock in the midst of its pasture, they will be noisy with men." And then the breaker, that's Yeshua. The breaker goes up before them. He breaks the siege. And they break out and pass through the gate and go out by it. So their king, this is Yeshua, goes on before them. Yeshua breaks the siege and leads Israel from out of danger into safety out of Bozrah. And the Lord Yeshua, Yahweh, and this is Yeshua, at their head. So he's the God-man. So Yahweh is leading his people to safety in Micah 2, 12 and 13. So here's a map of the area. Isaiah is in Jerusalem looking south to the region of Bozrah or Petra, and he watches, he observes the second coming. The initial point of the second coming will be Bozrah in southern Jordan, ancient Edom. That's the place of the second coming. Now we're at lesson 11, page 2, page 27 at the top of the page, section 205, the coming of the Son of Man. Now this is the second coming. Now we're in the Olivet Discourse, and let's review the three questions the disciples asked. Number one, what will be the sign that the temple in Jerusalem will be destroyed? The answer, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, Luke 21, 20 through 24. Second, what's the sign that the second coming is about to take place? That question has not been answered. Number three, what is the sign that the end of the age, the tribulation, has begun? The answer is Matthew 24, 7 and 8, a world war, World War I, leading to World War II. So those are the questions that have been asked. Now Yeshua is going to answer the second question. What's the sign that the second coming is about to occur? And Yeshua makes 4 points. Number one, there will be a total blackout. So no light penetrates down to the earth, and this is right as the tribulation comes to an end, Matthew 24, 29. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. So the end of the tribulation is marked by this intense blackout. It's as though, you know, the end of the play, and the curtain came down, and it came down in front of the sun. The tribulation is over. Second point, during that moment there'll be perplexity upon the earth, an incredible level of fear and confusion. Luke 21, 25 and 26. There will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and on the earth dismay among nations in perplexity at the roaring of the seas and the waves. Men fainting from fear and the expectation of things which are coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. So there's going to be perplexity and an incredible level of fear and confusion among the population on planet Earth. Then we come to the sign of the second coming itself, the Shekinah glory light in verse 30. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. So the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, which is the Shekinah glory light, will be visible throughout the world. This pitch blackness that suddenly descends upon the world will suddenly be dispersed by the Shekinah glory. And so the Shekinah glory will be visible throughout the world, so that all men will see the sign, even though Yeshua returns to one visible spot. And now fourthly, the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven will be the sign with the Shekinah glory of the second coming. The second coming itself will be a sign itself in the second part of the verse. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. So in these two verses, Yeshua summarizes what the Tanakh taught. The Tanakh taught that at the end of the second coming, there would be a worldwide regathering of the Jews. And that's what happens in verse 31. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together the elect, his elect from the four winds and from one end of the sky to the other. And again, the elect here refers to Israel in context. Now, Isaiah 11, 11, and 12 predicted that this is exactly what would happen. Then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. So all those areas mentioned are in the Middle East or Mediterranean region, but the worldwide regathering is much, much larger than just the Mediterranean region. And he will lift up a standard for the nations and assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. So it's a worldwide regathering in faith for the wonders of the Messianic kingdom, for the blessings of the Messianic kingdom. Now, Yeshua doesn't elaborate on this regathering of Israel because the Tanakh contains a lot of information on the regathering. Basically, he just pinpoints the timing of the second coming. That's his major point. All right. We're in lesson 11, page 28 at the top of the page, section 206, signs of nearness. It begins with an exhortation in verse 28. But when these things begin to take place, straighten up and lift up your heads because your redemption is drawing near. However, when you see these things, redemption is getting close at hand. Now, Luke is referring back to Luke 21, verses 10 and 11. These things refer to World War I and World War II. Luke is saying, when you see a world war, that signals that the end has begun and we're moving toward the tribulation. Now, remember, the rapture precedes the tribulation, and there are no signs for the rapture, so it could happen at any minute. Then we come to the parable of the fig tree, and this point is terribly misused by prophetic sensationalists. Matthew 24:32. Now, learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So, you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Now, there's been a lot of attention to this word generation, You need to be careful how you understand the word generation. Generation in the Bible is not limited to 80, 40, or 20 years. In Genesis 15, 16, it's 100 years. God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you will be buried in a good old age. Then in the fourth generation, 400 years, 100 years a generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." So be very careful when you encounter the word generation. It's best to view it in the sense of contemporary. You know, the 20th century generation of Americans, something like that. You know, the 20th century contemporaries, that kind of a thing. All right, now let's talk a little bit about the fig tree. Many use the fig tree as a symbol of Israel. However, the fig tree is a literal example here, not symbolic. In Luke 21:29, the fig tree is an illustration along with all the other trees. Then he told them a parable. "Behold, the fig tree and all the trees, as soon as they put forth leaves, you will see it and know yourselves that summer is now near. So you also, when you see these things happening, recognize that the kingdom of God is near." So when you see any tree budding, a fig tree or any tree, you know, summer's on its way. Summer's coming. That's the point. A certain event is coming when you see a precursor to that event. So these things in Matthew 24:33 is referring back to Matthew 24:15, which is the abomination of desolation. When that occurs, Messiah is near. He's standing right at the door. Now let's take a look at Matthew 24:34 again. "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." Now it's exactly 3.5 years between the abomination of desolation and the second coming. The Jewish nation that sees the abomination of desolation will be the generation, will be the contemporaries that sees the return of the Messiah. And they will still be alive when Yeshua returns. One third of them will still be alive. So verse 34 is a word of comfort because the abomination of desolation signals Satan's final attempt to destroy the Jews. Satan's program of Jewish destruction is doomed to failure. It will not succeed. So just to summarize this in a few comments, just as surely as summer comes after the trees bud, when you see the abomination of desolation, just as surely as the seasons, Yeshua is near, and the group of Jewish people will survive to witness his return. Now let's talk for a moment about the rapture of the church. In verse 36, we encounter a peri-day construction. This means a contrasting and new topic is beginning. Verse 36. "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone." When the rapture will be, no one knows. Only God the Father. Not the angels, not the Son. The Son doesn't know because he's functioning as a servant. He's limiting the use of his omniscience to the command of the Father. He's acting as a servant. And if the Father does not want him to exercise omniscience, he doesn't. This is Philippians 2, 5 through 8. So that's why he can say that the Son of Man doesn't know. But it'll happen sometime before the tribulation. Now we know when the second coming will occur. The tribulation is 7 years in length. The abomination of desolation occurs at the midpoint, the 3.5 year point. 1,260 days after the abomination of desolation, Yeshua will return. So we know that. But for the rapture, no one knows. All right, let's move on to Matthew 24:37 through 41. "For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For in those days, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Then there will be two men in the field, one will be taken, one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken, and one will be left. So the circumstances of the rapture, it'll come when there are relatively normal conditions on earth, just like the days of Noah. Relatively normal conditions. You know, it's not supposed to be bad enough for the rapture. I hear people say, it's getting so bad, the rapture's got to be close. But actually, the rapture will occur during relatively normal conditions. Now, during the second coming, that's a far different story. Things are far from normal during the second coming. But at the rapture, in contrast to the second coming, peri deconstruction, the rapture occurs when normal activities necessary for the propagation and sustenance of the human race are occurring. Now I'm going to close with a quick overview of the process of the first and second coming. This is on page 30 of your outline. The first and second coming are a process. So here's the broad sweep of events. This is not a detailed sequence of events. The process of the first coming. The first coming in humility. Yeshua coming as a babe in Bethlehem. Then the offer of the kingdom, followed by the rejection of the offer. Then the mystery form of the kingdom is explained. The basis of the second coming is revealed. The crucifixion and resurrection occurs. Then the ascension to the right hand of God the Father, and that's the conclusion of the first coming. Now we come to the process of the second coming. The church age begins at Pentecost or Shavuot. The mystery form of the kingdom commences. And that's the end of the church age. The end of the church age begins in World War I in 1914. The first regathering of Israel in unbelief in preparation for judgment occurred in 1948. Then the rapture will occur sometime. We don't know when. And that'll bring the church age to an end. And we'll be in judgment, we'll be in heaven, experiencing judgment in heaven for rewards. So we're in heaven getting rewarded, but there'll be judgment on earth for iniquity. This is the tribulation period, the time of Jacob's trouble. That'll lead to the national regeneration of Israel, the plea for the Messiah to return, the second coming in glory, the second regathering of Israel in faith in preparation for blessing, the institution of the Messianic Kingdom, and 1,000 years later, the eternal state begins. All right, I see I am 2 minutes over. So we'll pick it up next session in section 207 with 5 parables teaching watchfulness and faithfulness. So we hope to see you then. It'll be another fascinating chapter in the life, the Jewish life of the Messiah. Lehi Thraot.